Good morning. How we all doing? Good. Glad you guys are here. Let's open up to Daniel chapter 7. We'll continue our study there. Okay, Daniel chapter 7, vision of four beasts representing world kingdoms. God judges those beasts. Jesus is presented with dominion, glory, and a kingdom when he appears before God in heaven, the consummation of the ages. Then in verse 15, Daniel is wanting to know what the specifics about this vision mean. So he asks an angel. And an angel begins to explain what's going on. Verses 15 through 18 confirm for us that the four beasts do represent world powers. Okay? And verse 18 confirms for us that when Jesus receives that kingdom, up in verses 13 and 14, that the church also receives the kingdom. So probably one of the more cool things I've seen in the book of Daniel going through it this time is when we look at verses 13 and 14, Jesus is presented with a kingdom before the Ancient of Days. And when the angel interprets the vision, the angel says the saints receive the kingdom. So if there's any question about how one Jesus is with his people, well, that just answered it. And if anyone's trying to claim that there are no prophecies of the church in the Old Testament, they are clearly wrong. And Kevin couldn't be more right when he says, when you see prophetic language of Jesus in the Old Testament, his church is always not far behind. So, verse 19 is where we're going to pick it up. We'll read through the end of the chapter, and then I'll remind us. I'm going to present my case for this from the New Testament on what I believe these things could be a foreshadow for. I don't know if you could, you know, individually make the case that, you know, this represents this kingdom, this represents this king, this, I mean, I think this is bigger than that, but I'm going to kind of give you my take on how some of these pieces have fell into place since the prophecy has been written and as it's beginning fulfillment when Jesus ascends to heaven. Verse 19 says, "Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the ten horns that were on its head and the other horn which came up, before which three of them fell, namely the horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of the kingdom ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and will subdue three kings. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law. And they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will be set for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms over the whole heaven will be given to a people, the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and the dominions will serve and obey him." At that point, the revelation ended. "As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself." Daniel's not alarmed and his face is not growing pale because this is bad news. It's just a lot to process, okay? This is great. I mean, this is the saints of the Highest One receiving the kingdom and that his people reigning forever and all the kingdoms and dominion are serving and obeying Jesus Christ. So there's just a lot going on here. Quick little review from what we covered last week. Very difficult to try to take these visions and then interpret them chronologically. What I want you to see is the angel confirms for us that those four creatures do represent four world kingdoms. And then when you read verses 9 through 12, God judges them. Okay, that takes place in the days of the Roman rulers. Just like the statue, right? The rock that is Jesus that hits the statue and then grows into a mountain that covers the whole earth. It hit the statue where? In the feet, which were made of iron and pottery. So that tells us that towards the latter part of the fourth kingdom of iron, when it's beginning to become brittle, that's when God is going to send the rock, Jesus Christ. And indeed, Jesus was born under law, right? In the days of the Roman rulers. That's when Jesus came. And then when that rock grows into a mountain that covers the whole earth, what's the mountain? It's the church. That's why it would make sense then in Daniel 7, which is the same thing is happening here. Different emphasis. We've covered all of this already. Okay? That's why in Daniel 7, Jesus is being presented before the Ancient of Days and receiving a kingdom. And then the angel says that the church is receiving the kingdom at the same time, because that's the rock, which is Jesus, growing into a mountain that covers the whole earth. So the point here is those four earthly kingdoms do meet God's judgment, okay, in the days of the Roman rulers. Now, what was that judgment? What was it for? It was for communicating that the dominion that had been given to those kingdoms is now being taken and given to Jesus. Now, a lot of times I think this can be missed. But when we read Daniel 2, what does God have Daniel tell Nebuchadnezzar when he interprets the dream? He says, "You, O King of Kings, are the head of gold," right? And he says, "And to you has been given all dominion." So Nebi had it for a little while. He didn't do so well, did he? Turned him into a dog. How'd the king do after him? And how about the king after him? And how about the kings after them? You see why the statue's deteriorating in value? Yeah. Iron wasn't quite the bag of ashes that Reagan just handed me. Okay. But that's the thing that's being communicated here, is that the statue's descending in order of value. It started with gold. And God gave Nebuchadnezzar dominion. Okay. Well, what did man do with it? Well, he took it for himself and made himself God, right? So, in the days of the Roman kings, when Jesus comes and conquers death, right? God strips that dominion from that earthly kingdom and gives it to Jesus, to which now his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. That's what's going on here in Daniel chapter 7. That has taken place in verses 9 and 12. Now, the explanation of the vision is, well, there's this horn. I kind of picture it breaking off, right? This horn kind of breaks off, but the horn comes from the fourth beast, right? Okay, and then that horn goes and wages war with the saints. Okay, so what's happening here, verse 21, remember, earthly kingdoms have already been judged. If you want to try to make this a timeline, sometimes it doesn't work out so well. Dominion's been stripped and given to Jesus. So that whole 9 through 12 judgment of the Ancient of Days, that's already happened. Then in verse 21, he says, "I kept looking, and the horn is waging war with the saints and overpowering them." Well, the saints aren't on the scene until after Jesus has ascended back to the glory which he had with the Father before the world was. Amen? So now we see we are past the 9 through 12 Ancient of Days judgment, stripping the earthly kingdoms of their dominion and transferring it to Jesus. Now we have moved forward to the church age, where the saints are now on the earth, those who can be indwelt with God's Spirit because Jesus has been glorified. And this horn, which is a remnant of that fourth kingdom, has broken off, and now the horn is waging war with the saints. You guys tracking? Okay, verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days comes and judges? That is not the same Ancient of Days judgment as verses 9 through 12. So who's the Ancient of Days who's coming in judgment to bring judgment on that horn that would dare wage war and lift up its voice against God's elect? Jesus Christ. The Old Testament just called Jesus Christ the Ancient of Days. Is Jesus God? I mean, we've squashed about three entire Protestant Reformation denominations in 5 minutes. Just saying. Okay? So, that's what's going on here. Now, the angel, in explaining this to Daniel, and Daniel clearly wondering, is very clear that the fourth beast that has the ten horns is very different than the three before it. Even physically speaking, when you read it, is very different. The first three are actually just animals, something that we could easily understand. We said lions, leopards, and bears, oh my, right? Okay, very easy to understand. The fourth one is not called an animal, it's just called dreadful and terrifying, and it has iron teeth and it crushes everything. It's something else, okay? Now that makes sense, because here's where we pick up from where we left off last week. Kind of keeping in theme with that initial, what are the physical differences, because now we will finish class by talking about the spiritual differences. What made Rome so different from the three kingdoms that were before it on that statue? You guys remember this? You know, Nebi's granddad comes into town, into old Israel, who began that conquest. Now, he didn't finish it. Nebi gets credit for that. He comes in and he conquers your town. What's he do? He burns that thing to the ground. And that's what they did to the Israelites, right? That temple that we're reading about as the foreshadows is Mr. Strommel's going through the tabernacle system. That temple in the Old Testament got burnt to the ground. Everybody was killed, and then if you could be of service, you were enslaved. And then you were brought back to Babylonian country, right? And you partook of their food, their language, their customs, and their religion, right? I mean, we have an example of this in the first chapter of the book that we're studying. Daniel, along with some other young, strong men, teenagers, were brought from Israel to Babylon, right? And what's the first thing Daniel 1 says about what they did? Eat our food, learn the Chaldean culture, which is the language, okay? And adopt our ways. And then you will be our servants and you will serve us. Persia, Medes, Egyptians, Romans, Greeks, the Greeks, no different. Now, what's different about the Romans? The Romans come into town and they conquered you, but they did something a little different, the first of their kind. They didn't steal all your people and burn your city down and make you eat their food. They said, well, you can keep your monetary system, you can keep your religion, you can even keep your king if you like, just as long as he's not, you know, higher than King Caesar, and just pay your taxes. So that's why the old Pontius Pilate even had a job in the first place. He wasn't prefect, he was actually peacekeeper. That's what his title should have been, okay? His job was to make sure that I mean, when you give people that much liberty, what are they going to eventually do with it? You know, they're going to try and carve out a kingdom for themselves. That's what happened in 70 AD. You guys understand that? And that's what worked against Rome. Now, I'm not here to start a debate on what caused the fall of Rome. we'd be here. Well, they've been doing that for 2,000 years, still to this day. And we don't have 2,000 years. We got potluck in a few hours, right? So, I believe a major contributing factor is why the clay was mixed with the iron. Okay? The kingdom that was tough as iron, that crushed and trampled all the kingdoms before it, ended up making itself very brittle because its stretch was really broad, but it was very divided inside of itself. I mean, you've got too many, you know, I mean, the Jews even had their own king, although appointed by the Romans. I understand that, you know, but I mean, King Herod, right? We all have heard of him before. Like, how is there a king reigning when Caesar's king? Because that's how divided the Roman Empire was and how much freedom and flexibility the people were given. Okay, so a few years just ahead of 70 AD, some of the Jews, you know, because they couldn't get Jesus to do it, you know, they really wanted Jesus to raise up that army and take out the Romans, right? And Jesus made it really clear from the very beginning that that wasn't his plan. So they had to reject him because that's not the Messiah that they wanted, right? So, you know, a few years later, the Jews end up revolting against the Romans. Victoriously, might I add. Yeah. So that's where we get, you know, all those prophecies about, you know, the coming abomination of desolation and then the subsequent Romans destroying the city of Jerusalem, which if you guys have been here on Wednesday, this is all fresh on your mind. Okay. That's what was unique about Rome is there's this great power struggle inside the empire itself because they gave all of these nations that they had conquered way too much freedom. Okay. So they were very different in their tactics. Okay. And I believe Rome to be the fullness of the abomination that began with the Babylonian Empire, just in its anti-God agenda. Okay. So what I want us to do here is go to Revelation 13. Try to figure out how I want to do this. Okay. Because I don't want to bury us in this chapter this morning. And I said 13, didn't I? No, I meant 12. Okay. That's how far my brain is behind. Okay. In the Old Testament, you're Satan, and you want to thwart God's plan. Right? I mean, that's since Satan's rebellion in heaven, God created the earth in response to Satan's rebellion. We understand that? God's mission to produce a people who would worship him in spirit and in truth without ever seeing him, which is what God has accomplished through the church, and by doing that proves he is righteous and that Satan is wrong. Make sense? So God is way more interested in proving that he is right than proving his might. Now, he is not self-righteous. He is righteousness. And righteousness is always vindicated. Always. Okay? Cannot stand in the face of wickedness. So when wickedness is found in the heavenly places, okay, God has to make the earth. Why? Because he's going to produce a people who don't see him, believe in him, which the angels apparently couldn't do. Okay? Love him and worship him in spirit and truth, proving that he is righteous in the one true God. And that is the testament and the judgment against the angels on judgment day, us. So that's how y'all judge the angels, okay? Your faith. So that's why this whole thing kicks off. So since then, Satan's plan is to stop God's plan. So let's go into the Old Testament. How do you stop God's people if you're Satan in the Old Testament? Thank you, Mark Taylor. David, I will raise up, you know, yeah. Moses, I will raise up a prophet like you, he says in Deuteronomy. And he will lead my people. And they will listen to his voice. David, from you, I will raise up a king who will rule forever. So what Satan's like, oh, this is easy. All I got to do is kill David. And God's plan is done. So he sent the Philistines. Isn't your Old Testament fun when you actually like understand what's happening? Okay. All right. But man, David never lost that war, you know, faithful to God. So God protects them. So you can picture your Satan here and you're just throwing the Egyptians at him. Now I've got them, right? Enslave them for hundreds of years. Nope. Now this prophet that's a foreshadow and type of the Redeemer Christ comes, Moses, rescues them again. Well, let's take out David. Oh, that doesn't work, you know. Well, let's take out Israel. That doesn't work. Let's try to destroy Judah. And then God has this little plan where he's like, just go to Babylon willingly and I'll preserve a small little remnant. You see how God's always one step ahead of Satan? So, okay, good job. You're Satan and you want to thwart God's plan and you want to kill his people in the Old Testament. What do? You send an army with chariots and weapons and you cut them down. Okay. Now, you're Satan. Can you stop God's plan in the church age? You cannot. The kingdom's everlasting. The dominion has been stripped and transferred. All those who have been transferred into the kingdom of the beloved Son have everlasting life. Satan cannot take that. I mean, if he wants to send a physical army to kill all the Christians, where does he send them? Like, Canada? I mean, it ain't physical. It's a spiritual kingdom. He doesn't fight that way anymore, does he? So what was the culmination of the abomination of the anti-God agenda in the Roman Empire, the fullness of what started in Babylon, switches, changes its fight, branches off into a horn, and then wages war with God's people with blasphemous words, not with swords. That's how Satan wars against God's people now. With eyes and a horn and blasphemous words. Now, what's Satan saying that's blasphemous? So he's not punching God's people in the face anymore, hacking them down with a sword. He's saying, well, what's he saying? He's saying, well, you can accept Jesus into your heart. That's what he's saying. I haven't found that verse in the Bible yet, have you? Oh, Satan's good at what he does. He tricks people, doesn't he? You guys understand. You go look this up for yourself. You know, go to your Bible search engines. Try to find anywhere where it says you can accept Jesus into your heart. Doesn't say that. Okay? Uttering blasphemous things against God. Right? Saying baptism is a work. I've never seen that in the Bible. Have you? I have seen a verse that says we're saved through our faith in the working of God. In our immersions into Christ. That's in Colossians chapter 2. Galatians 3 says that you're children of God through your faith because those of you who were baptized into Christ clothed yourselves with Christ through your faith. Right? So what I want us to see is in the Old Testament, God's creation of the earth was his answer to the wickedness that Satan brought into the heavenly places. And Satan's like, man, I got this. This is going to be easy. I'll just make them all curse your name and die. And how is Satan doing? How'd Adam and Eve do? You know, well, not so good, huh? How about their children? How'd they do? I mean, if you're Satan, you're sitting there thinking, I'm doing pretty good here, you know? Yeah. I mean, Adam and Eve are already doing the exact opposite of what you tell them to, and the boys are already killing each other. You're 1,700 years into this thing, and the whole world is so anti-God that you had to flood the whole thing. I bet Satan was feeling pretty proud in that moment. What about you? 300 years after the flood, God's ready to install the next phase of his plan and to bring up a physical nation to foreshadow and type the church. And he just needs one man to be righteous, to be the father of that nation. And he only has Abraham left on the earth. That's how quick it went from the flood downhill. And the whole way Satan shows up to the meeting, you know, he brought the donuts in Job. And they said, they have this big meeting in heaven. And Job comes up. God says, Job's a righteous man. You see what they're arguing about in the first place? Is whether or not mankind will remain righteous and worship and serve God. And Satan says, oh, I can get him. I got Adam. I got Eve. I got Cain. Right? I got them all. You put Job on the timeline wherever you want. Okay? Maybe he's got all the people before or after the flood. You decide. Okay? He's like, oh, I'll just give him to me, God. I'll make him curse you. This whole war. So you're Satan in the Old Testament. You're feeling pretty good. Then Jesus the Christ arrives on the scene, and he gets a good 3-year run, and then they kill him. You got to be feeling pretty good if you're Satan, don't you? And then all of a sudden, Acts says the gates of Hades couldn't even hold Jesus if he wanted to stay. And he was raised from the dead. And he took the blood of that sacrifice, and he went all the way up to heaven, offered it in the holy places, and we just read it in Daniel chapter 7, the consummation of the ages when the Son of Man is presented before the Ancient of Days. And Satan's fate was sealed. Job shows us that Satan had access to the heavenly places before Jesus' ascension. He brought the donuts. Go check it out. That's a joke. But Jesus said something interesting in a prophetic perfect statement. He said, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Satan got the boot out of heaven, and we know it because of Revelation chapter 12, when Jesus conquered death and ascended back to heaven with the blood of that sacrifice. Satan was removed from heaven. Heaven was cleansed of his existence in heaven, and his fate was sealed. Do you guys see the picture? So what's he going to do? Raise up an army of the Philistines and kill David's lineage? What's he going to do? Send an army to Canada and kill all the Christians? I mean, what does Satan do? I'm trying to show you that fourth beast was different, and it was different for a reason, physically and spiritually. Okay? Now, how does Satan wage war now? He does it through false doctrine. But it's no different than what he said to Eve. He's relying on his trickery and his lies more than just his, I'll kill you with my sword and my army. He can't stop God's plan anymore. He can't stop the Christ. He can't stop the lineage to the Christ. He can't stop his own demise. He was hanging on the side of the cliff. Jesus came, stomped on the fingers, conquered death. Satan is currently falling into the pit of hell. That was prepared for him, and all he can do is grab as many people on the way down as he can. But there's nothing he can do to stop God. And to stop God's church. All he can do is tailor make specific little temptations and lies for you individually to try to pull you away as he is already on his way down. That is the horn. That is why it is broken off. It is waging war differently in this life than it did in the Old Testament. And he does it through uttering blasphemous things against God. Okay? And so he's going to do that lots of ways, and Revelation 13 would be a great chapter to read how he does that. He uses world government to institute anti-Christian legislation, and he does that, okay? He also uses the other beast to spread false doctrine, okay? And that's what Satan does. Try to help us understand before we read Revelation 12, like how Satan has really changed his strategy. I want us to go to Romans chapter 8. This is how I'll do this. And then, Ethan, thanks for joining us today. Your job is to remind me about a Louis Vuitton bag. Because I'm about to chase a rabbit here, and I don't know if I'm going to make my way back. So you're going to help me out. Yep, you have to remind me of that. Well, bag or beg, however you say it, you know. I mean, you're awfully close to that, you know, Alberta border there, you know. You say beg? Yeah, okay, yeah. You know, you're a northern Montanan, you know. So the Midwesterners make fun of us, you know. I really wish Karen was here this morning. She likes to give me a hard time, so. Okay, Verse 9, Romans 8, verse 9. However, you are not in the flesh. You have to remember, this is written to Christians. So Paul's trying to get the Christian to understand his position he's in as a Christian. So verse 9, he says, however, you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. But if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he doesn't belong to him. Like this, okay, all right. So the Bible's teaching is... You are in the Spirit if the Spirit of God is in you. Is the Spirit of God in you, Christian? You're spiritual then. It's like it's not hard to understand, right? Anybody who's not a Christian is just fleshly. Make sense? You have flesh. You started that way. But now that you have God's Spirit, you are now spiritual. Makes sense. And then he adds another qualifier. If you don't have the Spirit of Christ, you don't belong to him. Okay, so looks to me like the Bible's teaching is if you're in and you're a Christian, you have God's Spirit. And you're not in if you don't have God's Spirit. Have we laid that foundation? That's why Judgment Day is not going to be such a puzzle. The atheists and the scientists aren't going to be arguing with God about where was the proof. There is just going to be the people who have God's Spirit and who are spiritual, and those who don't and who are not spiritual, and then God's going to go, Spirit, non-spirit. Spirit, non-spirit. And those who have God's Spirit go to heaven. And it is that simple. Kind of. Now, you go to Acts chapter 2. I say kind of, because there's actually a lot happening on Judgment Day. You have to study it out sequentially. But, okay, now look at Acts chapter 2. The gospel message is being preached for the first time. Jesus has been killed, raised, and ascended back to the Father, glory, in heaven. And Peter has just made the message. You look at verse 32. This Jesus God raised up, to which we are witnesses. So you have millions of Jews in town who are hearing this message that we killed Jesus and he was the Messiah, but God raised him from the dead. So in verse 37, when they hear this, they're pierced to the heart. Shocker. They just realize they killed the Messiah. And Peter said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, brethren, what should we do? And Peter said, you should repent. And if each of you be baptized in the name of Jesus for the forgiveness of your sins, and you will receive the gift of the Spirit. Did I make that complicated? If you don't have God's Spirit, are you in? How do you get God's Spirit? Did the Bible say it or did I say it? The Bible said it. How many of y'all have sat in other places that say you can get God's Spirit a different way? I've sat in congregations where people came up front because the pastor said, if you're ready to dedicate your life to Jesus Christ, you come on up. And so they come on up and they kneel up here and they pray a prayer and they say, Jesus, I'm ready to follow you. I invite you to live into my heart. And in that moment, they say Jesus went into their heart, the Spirit of God. Did the Bible teach that? I showed you the verses this morning. I did not say it. God said it. So what does the horn do that's waging war with the saints? Do you see my point? What does that horn do? He doesn't send an army to Canada. He doesn't send out plagues to kill people. He sends out blasphemous words. And he gets millions of people to believe that they have received Jesus' Spirit because they prayed it into their heart. And the Bible never says you can do that. It shows us how to do it. That's why we, by faith, obey His will and His word. That's what that horn is doing. Okay? I picked you for a reason, Ethan, because you're sitting right there, and I knew you would remind me just by looking. Say, that's what Satan, that's what the horn is in Daniel. That's uttering blasphemous things. It's getting people really close to the truth, but not all the way. So they think they're okay, and then they never think to ask, am I right with God? You see, that's how Satan wages war today. I had a friend in high school. I was a senior, and she had gone to Mexico. And her dad was a president for the Montana Oil Association. It's on 27th down by Walker. It's above Walker's. Or at least it was 100 years ago. So they had, my point is they had oil money, right? We all know what that means. The left likes that term. They had oil money. So they went to Mexico on vacation and they bought their 17-year-old daughter a Louis Vuitton handbag. Do you know how much that thing costs 100 years ago? $2,500. What do you think that's worth today? $7,000? I'll never forget how much she'd complained to us, our group of friends. She came back to Montana, and she saw all the other 17-year-old girls in school with a bag that looked just like hers, but they paid $20 at the mall for it. It's called a knockoff. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? Well, she didn't like that too much. Now, why didn't she like that too much? She paid $3,000 for her bag. Hold, Jeremy. She's got the real deal, doesn't she? And the rest of them are all fakes. She must have told us 100 times. That one's fake. See how the label wraps over the L, you know, like. Well, I mean, if you're going to rip off somebody, you have to pattern it slightly different somewhere. The seams are always the place to do it, just saying. You know, I learned a lot, you know, from the Louis Vuitton bag, okay? Now, you're God. How authentic is your bag? Did anybody hear Kendall's opening this morning? His word is everlasting. Jesus says in the Gospel of John that when he was on earth, he did not come to judge the world. And that's true. He came to die. And he did that. He said, but the world does have a judge. It's the words that I spoke that are going to judge on judgment day. This is eternal. This is the $3,000 handbag. It doesn't change. It's God's word. What does Satan do? Satan twists it and he sells knockoff versions. And he steals millions who even think they're Christians. It's tremendously sad. You got verses in the Gospel of Matthew where Jesus' own words were, on that judgment day when the Ancient of Days is presented and the horn is judged, many, many people, the Gospel of Matthew says, many people will say, did we not prophesy and perform miracles in your name? And Jesus will say, depart from me, I never knew you. That means that there are people on judgment day who called on the name of Christ in this life who still don't make it. Because they got sold a knockoff bag. Usually because they were entrusting their salvation to the preacher. You know, don't do that. My job is to not stink at my job and to be a good communicator and to lay these things out in an accurate way. I must be skilled at that. But I am not the source of your faith. This book is. And it is on you. Okay? Rain, I see it. I got to wait because I have already taken the largest detour I have ever made. Okay, but I really just wanted to work on that here. Somehow I'm not in Revelation 12, so hopefully you guys still are. Okay, I just and look, if I ever check in to see if you guys understand, it's me seeing if I've done my job correctly. You guys are bright. A lot of you guys have this stuff figured out. You've had it figured out for a long time. But I just really, really, I think to do Daniel 7 justice and to make sense of this horn and this blasphemous name and words and time, times, and half a times and the changing of law, it's very complicated. And I want you to leave having an understanding of what's happening. What's happening is the changing of the way that Satan is now waging war. And he has to change the way that he's waging war because he has been defeated by Jesus' ascension. He is falling off the cliff. He is on his way to the bottomless pit that was created for him. All he can do is trick people along the way to follow him. And he might get them to follow the desires of their heart and the lusts of their mind. Sure. But you know where he makes a lot of inroads with pulling people apart? False teaching. False teaching. He gets people like he did to Eve, and he takes the truth, which is, you won't die today, right? He twists it into a lie. And he gets people so close to the $3,000 version, but they end up buying the knockoff and they don't know any better. They got to be in the Word. Now here's the proof of, large proof of everything that we've laid the framework here for. So, if you look at verse 3 of Revelation chapter 12, you see, a sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns. Like, are you surprised now? Shocker! You know, who's the horns? Like, oh, it was Satan, okay? I'm telling you that I don't want you to go in history and start counting 10 kings. Okay, here's this king, this king, this king. And these 3 were in Asia. And the 4th and the 5th were in Africa. It's like, please don't do that. Revelation tells you how to understand this. Okay? So, 7 heads, 10 horns. On the heads were 7 diadems. His tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth so that she gave birth that might devour the child. So, the dragon, who this chapter will tell us is the devil. We have to be very careful to let the Bible, I mean, it's kind of easy to know it's the devil, but the Bible itself does define him as the devil. Okay? He took a third of the stars from heaven. Remember we said, what kicked off this whole thing in the first place? Satan's rebellion. Did angels follow Satan in his rebellion? Does that mean it was exactly 33.33% of them? This book is highly symbolic, but one-third's a pretty good chunk, isn't it? You know, my mother-in-law bakes me a cream pie every year for Thanksgiving, and nobody likes that thing except me, okay? And if that thing showed up with a third of it missing, that's a pretty good chunk gone missing. So you got Satan, who has defied God, and he takes a third of the angels with him. It doesn't mean 33 1/3%. It means he took a sizable chunk with him. And now what's he doing? He's hiding in the back of the delivery room. So that way when... Did you guys see that? The end of verse 4. The dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth that he might devour the child. He's sitting and hiding behind a curtain in the delivery room waiting for Mary to birth the Son of God so he can kill it. That's how Satan has warred against God prior to Jesus Christ. He just killed everything. And he sent armies. Do you see why Herod ordered the execution of all the male children 2 years of age or younger? That's because of this verse right here. Verse 5, she gives birth to the son, a male child, the ruler of nations, the rod of iron. Her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God so that she'd be nourished for 1,260 days. We have to remember that number. Hopefully we get to it tonight. We have 4 minutes. Got your seatbelts on? We're not going to get there. Don't stress. You know, you were like the people on that ride when right before it's about to take off at the roller coaster, some guy says, oh no! You know, right before they hit the go button, all your faces were like, what are we doing? You know? There's verse 7. There's war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. What did we say earlier? Satan eventually got booted and removed from his place in heaven. He loses the war. The great dragon's thrown down. The serpent of old, who's called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world, he was thrown down to earth. The angels with him were thrown down. And then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now, salvation, power, and the kingdom of God, and the authority of his Christ. This is everything that we read in Daniel 7, the consummation of the ages. The authority of his Christ, the dominion, have come. For the accuser of the brethren has been thrown down. He accuses them before our God day and night, and they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb. So that tells us when Satan met his final blow, when he lost the war against God. When? At the blood of the Lamb. Well, when did that happen? Well, he shed it on Calvary, went to Hades, raised 3 days later, ascended to heaven, Hebrews 9 says, with the blood of that sacrifice, and booted Satan out of heaven. You see the picture? This is everything that we've talked about this morning. And Satan has lost. He gets kicked out of heaven, and he's kicked out and triumphed over the blood of the spotless Lamb. Jesus has gained victory. Verse 13, when the dragon, okay, let me try again. When Satan saw that he was thrown down to earth, he persecuted the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for a time, times, and half a time. For the presence of the serpent. And the serpent poured water out like a river of his mouth after the woman so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. But the earth helped the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. See, Satan tried his old tactics. He tried to stop God's plan. He tried to get God's people. He sent the water to swarm them like a tsunami. And God came to the side of the church and rescued her. Verse 17. This is the verse that brings everything together. So the dragon was enraged with the woman, who represents the church, and went off to make war with the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Satan figured out right away that once Jesus rose from the dead and offered the blood of that sacrifice and victory was ensured for God's team, he tried one more time to war against God's plan like he had in the Old Testament, but he could not stop the church, could he? God came to the aid of the church. So what does he do? He just resolves in his defeat to wage war individually to see if he can pull as many people as he can away from the Lord as possible. Okay, we'll finish Daniel chapter 7 next week, and now we'll understand how some of those things began to take place in the early church age and how it's continued to take place up into today. Okay? The one thing that you'll want to remember that's going to help make sense of this is in Daniel, it said that the horn would wage war with the saints for how long? Time, times, half a time. And Revelation confirmed for us that when Satan wars with the church, it's for a time, times, and half a time. These two times are symbolic for each other. They're representative of each other. And we want to cover that as well. Thanks for your attention.